3.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And let me just tell you, this bill doesn't have a lot of lines or changes or anything, but it does something I think that probably was the intent of the legislature. I could be wrong. I've worked on campaign finance issues over the years. And when someone called me concerning a House campaign this past fall, they wondered if the paper plates and forks that were used at the fundraiser could be counted as a non-campaign disbursement. And it sounds so silly, but they were up against their spending limit. And found out, and I said, well, they have to be, because, I mean, you can have entertainment. You can have Bruce Springsteen, for crying out loud. But, and beverages and food, but not the plates. And I guess you could ask people to bring their own plates and utensils, but probably we don't mean that. And so we've added unnecessary utensils and supplies, which I think probably makes sense. I hope you agree that it makes sense.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
Senator Scheid, I wonder if it would be informative to indicate what kinds of things we're thinking of with that, and saying, and necessary utensils and supplies, including dinnerware, so that the scope of what it's talking about is a little bit clearer. Dinnerware to include, I mean, rather than having to put in there paper plates and
from Hallmark
knives and forks, no, but at utensils, I maybe even and instead of necessary utensils, to put in beverages, dinnerware, and supplies.
We don't need beverages.
Beverages is already in there.
Right.
Right.
What would you think of that as a...
Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, that's fine. I didn't craft this language, but I think that's what I want to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, it sort of makes sense. I mean, I'd want to include the plastic or the paper tablecloth and the
napkins. I think dinnerware and supplies would get that.
And so dinnerware and supplies does cover that. My staff calls this the forks and spoons. I don't think we need to get that specific.
Right.
But that's what we call this bill in my office.
Madam Chair, I wonder if I see Mr. Goldsmith is in the audience. I wonder if I could just ask him to comment. Mr. Goldsmith, given that you'd understand the intent of Senator Scheid's bill, would you think it would be easier to administer when someone puts that down as a category for non-campaign disbursement under the fundraising event, to have language like and dinnerware and supplies as opposed to necessary utensils? What would be the easiest to oversee for the board, do you think?
Mr. Goldsmith, welcome to the committee.
Or
please
neither,
identify yourself.
Or either one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board. Senator Rest, Madam Chair, members, the board is aware of this problem. We share Senator Scheid's understanding of it, and we welcome her solution. It's been a difficult area because it seems so illogical that you can provide everything except the throwaways, essentially, for a fundraiser. And so this would clarify something that's confused lots of people. From the board's perspective, the bill as written would be completely acceptable, and we could apply it that way. It would be just as acceptable to say dinnerware. We recognize the problem, and this gives the board the opening then to have the paper plates, the plastic forks, maybe some decorations, paper tablecloths, and so on. So either set of language would be equally acceptable to the board.
Madam Chair, then I would move that Senate File 423 be recommended to pass and refer to the full committee unless there is someone who wishes to testify.
Right. Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify on Senate File 423? All those in favor of Senate File 423, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator
Madam
Scheid.
Chair and committee members, thank you very much, and thanks to Senator Moi for...
Senator Moi, welcome to the committee. Senate File 564, unless you have a preference for which one you'd like to do first.
Let me just arrange that between you. Madam Chair and members, thank you very much. I would like to start with 564. The two bills are similar enough that if I could beg the committee's indulgence, I would like to, I have two witnesses here who would like to speak in general to the two bills, so it would be more informational to create the context for why we feel these two bills are important. And so if it's, with your permission, Madam Chair, I would like to ask the two witnesses to give their testimony, and then I will give the specifics of 564, and then followed by the other bill.
And Senator Moi, I see there's an amendment. Should we adopt that first to get the
yes, Madam Chair.
Shape you'd like?
Yes, that I would appreciate that.
Senator Rest moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I have with me today Professor Chris Eugen from the University of Minnesota Law School, who has done some extensive research, and he would like to share some of the information. I've asked him to come and share some of the information on this issue with members of the committee. And also, I think his testimony will create a better context for what the two bills are trying to do that will be different from what it is that we're currently doing under current law. And then he will be followed by Mr. Andre Corbett, who is an ex-felon who was able to vote for the first time this year, and he would like to share the experience with you. I also have at the table Mr. Jonathan Maurer-Jones, who is staffed with Take Action Minnesota, who brought Senate File 564 to me. And if you look around the room today, there are a number of individuals here representing not only themselves but a number of organizations who are very much in support of this effort to restore the right to vote to our men and women who have been incarcerated. So, Madam Chair, I would like to ask Professor Eugen to begin.
Professor, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Eugen. I'm a McKnight Professor of Sociology and Chair of the Department of Sociology at the University of Minnesota. States vary greatly in the extent to which they disenfranchise various correctional populations. Minnesota currently disenfranchises current prison inmates, those on conditional release who've served their prison time, felony probationers, and convicted felons in jail. As Mr. Corbett will attest, notification practices are currently inconsistent. I'd like to mention first that disenfranchisement has risen greatly in the state of Minnesota, affecting about 8,800 people in 1974, 25,000 by 1990, and now currently about 67,000 Minnesotans are disenfranchised. Only about one in four of these disenfranchised Minnesotans are incarcerated, partly due that Minnesota runs a very lean Department of Corrections and makes extensive use of community corrections so that individuals may maintain their ties to their communities, their families, and their employment. The disenfranchisement has its biggest effect on communities of color. Currently, about 10% of Minnesotans are disenfranchised. 10% of African American Minnesotans are disenfranchised. About 6.6% of American Indians in Minnesota are disenfranchised, and about 1% of whites are disenfranchised by virtue of these laws. And were this bill to go forward, that those percentages would drop significantly and would fall to less than half of those that I just mentioned. I've conducted, as part of my research for Locked Out, Felon Disenfranchisement in American Democracy, I conducted a Harris poll asking Americans whether they supported voting rights for various groups. Clearly, a majority supports re-enfranchising probationers and parolees, about 68% in the case of probationers, about 60% in the case of parolees. But that support stops at the prison gate, such that only about 31% favored restoring the right to vote for those who are currently incarcerated. I also have conducted research in Oregon, which has a regime similar to the one proposed here, in which probationers and parolees can vote. Oregon is similar to Minnesota in many respects, although there's voting by mail in that state. In each case, for both probationers and parolees, those who vote are significantly less likely to reoffend. We cannot make any strong claims about causality based on these data, but it's certainly the case that such a bill would not compromise public safety. It would appear to do the opposite. And then finally, I've left on the research brief that. With you, a list of current state laws. There's tremendous diversity across the United States, varying from states such as Maine and Vermont that permit prisoners to vote absentee to states that disenfranchise even beyond the period of sentence. Minnesota would be moving from a situation similar to Alaska, Arkansas, and Georgia, in which inmates, parolees, and probationers are disenfranchised, to a situation more like that in Illinois, Indiana, and Michigan, in which only incarcerated inmates are disenfranchised. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, do you have the note? I apologize. I should have made it more explicit that the professor is going to be speaking from these notes. The national survey is presented on page 2 or slide 8 on the back of this page. I found it interesting the different states and where they're at, and that Minnesota, where Minnesota is at, but if you look at our neighbors, Illinois and Indiana and Michigan and North Dakota and South Dakota, they're one of the 14 states that disenfranchise inmates only. Next, I will ask Mr. Andre Corbett to speak about his personal experience.
Mr. Corbett, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Andre Corbett, I'm currently employment support consultant with Goodwill Easter Seals Reentry Program and ex-offender myself. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. When I was 20 years old, just caught up in almost a lifestyle of living in poverty and making my own decisions after having moved out when I was 15 years old, got into some trouble and was convicted of one robbery. Actually, I was convicted of three. One of them I did do, two of them I did not do. At the point in time when I was convicted, it never was fully explained to me which of my rights will be taken away. It never was explained that I would not be able to vote until I completed my sentence. Upon release, it's still, when I got out of prison, it never was explained to me that I still couldn't vote, even though I was aware of that. But there are so many others who are incarcerated that upon release, they do not know about their voting rights and how it affects. The only thing that I got was when I completed my sentence, I got a letter in the mail stating that all of my civil rights will be restored, as well as the right to vote and hold public office. And what really hit me was the civil rights and the right to vote. And I did not know, like I said, upon when I took the deal that I took, that I would not be able to vote. And currently I work at Goodwill Easter Seals with the reentry program, where I'm working directly with men coming out of prison. And so we do a lot of explaining to them about their voting rights, because they're not being told upon when they get out or when they go to prison that what their exact rights are. I voted for the first time. I got off parole in August of 2008, and I voted for the first time this year. And I remember going to the polls, and it was really like the best thing that happened to me in quite a while. I felt more as part of the community. I felt more like my community was embracing me more, and that's why I really support this bill, because a lot of us coming from prison have this us versus them mentality, and a way to engulf them back in the community. And I believe, as with Oregon, to reduce the recidivism is it makes them feel part of that community again, to where they're not more where we're not more prone to go out and commit more crime, where we actually feel a part of the community, open up the doors for employment, open up the doors for housing, as well as opening up the doors for me to vote. Engulfs me back in the community, as well as for family and friends as well. I have nieces, nephews, goddaughters who, if I'm able to vote when it comes to certain issues that pertains to them, it makes me feel more part of that community. And like I remember driving back from the voting polls and voting day, and just the spirit of people, cars packed up, people, little college kids running around with their, you know, chests painted. And that spirit was really, I was like, wow, it really hit me that this is what the whole voting thing was about. And that's why I support this bill, because, like I said, it just engulfs us back in the community more, to where we feel to be more part of the community, to get engaged, to teach our children, to teach those coming behind us about what it is in the political process. I brought my two goddaughters here today because I want to show them, get them started early at this is the political process. You have a right to come down here. A lot of us, when these meetings come up, aren't here, those who are on probation or parole, because we feel like we can't vote, we don't have a voice. And that's one thing that I encourage individuals to do, is to vote when they do have the opportunity. So this bill just engulfs us back into the community more. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Jonathan Maurer-Jones is going to help me answer questions about the bill if I get stuck. So he's not going to testify, but he'll be here to answer questions. So, Madam Chair and members, Senate File 564, as amended by the A2 Delete Everything Amendment, seeks to achieve three main things. One, it will restore voting rights to people convicted of a felony at the point they are released from incarceration or placed on probation or parole instead of at the end of the felony sentence. Number two, Senate File 564 requires notice about voting rights to be provided before a plea is accepted and at the point a person's voting rights are restored, whether that is at the point when they're released from incarceration or if they're not sent to prison, but if they are put on probation or on parole, we notify them they still have the right to vote. And number three, it requires the Secretary of State to help publicize and provide information about these changes to judges, the correction officials, election officials, and the public. And on this third piece, we have asked for input from the Secretary of State's office so that we could craft it in a way that is not too onerous for them. Now, just to be fully upfront, we made the changes, and the Secretary of State's office, with their input and their suggestions, they only saw the Delete Everything Amendment this morning. So if they have any other comments or changes to it, I would welcome them to come and speak to that. But we did get input from them. We've tried to incorporate that into the Delete Everything Amendment. So Section 1 of the bill, Madam Chair, changes the definition of restoration of civil rights to achieve really our purpose number one, which is to allow people who are...
Just a minute, please. Senator Rest has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Moore, would you, when you're going through the Delete Everything Amendment, indicate it, if there is any kind of policy change as opposed to a technical change between the bill as introduced?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, and I will try to do that, and maybe Mr. Bodron can help me where I am deficient. He has been phenomenal and very helpful in helping us do this. So, section one of the bill.
I have to bring donuts next time.
I know. Section one of the bill speaks to the purpose number one, which is to say that we now would like the right to vote to be restored at the point when the person is discharged from incarceration. For people who are currently on probation or parole, we are giving them now the right to vote. Section 2 of the bill changes the voter registration application to conform with the change that we're making in Section 1. Section 3 of the bill is, well, under current law, the, you know, the state court administrator has to report certain information. And so we're just adding the sentence and the period to which they're sentenced to incarceration to be part of that information so that we will know when somebody is released from incarceration to be able to confirm the information. Section 4 of the bill speaks to the request to the Secretary of State to develop information about this new voting right at the restoration. And we ask that they make this information electronically available to state court administrators and judges and others for distribution. Oops. I'm all twitchy today. Section 5 of the bill, Section 5 of the bill makes, again, it's a substantive language change, but it changes the Voters' Bill of Rights to conform to the changes that we're making in Section 1 of the bill to speak to, you know, the release from incarceration. Section 6 of the bill, again, changes the policy of who is eligible to be a registered voter, again, to reflect the changes that we're making in Section 1. Section 7 is a bigger change. Section 7 spells out that we would like to ask each of the correctional facilities to designate an official within the facility to provide a notice, the notice that's in the bill, as well as to provide a voter registration card. Where it changes substantially from the bill as introduced, the bill as introduced requires the correctional officers to both go get training, to answer questions, and to collect the voter registration card. I felt on second review of the bill that we didn't want to do that. We felt that the Secretary of State's office does a very good job of providing the information. The voter registration cards have already been printed. We didn't want our corrections officers to have to become election law experts. And so to the degree that we would like them to provide the notice and to provide a voter registration card, we felt that was adequate. Also, at the time when a person is physically released from incarceration, they might not know where the permanent address is going to be. And so I think that we made a pretty substantive change in this section from the bill as introduced. So it merely asks that whoever the facility to designate somebody to give the notice and to give the voter registration card. I have to say that we've put a call into corrections. I've not heard back from them, but I am willing to, I'm anticipating their input on this, and I'm willing to make this as, you know, least onerous on them as possible. The notice requirement is printed in the back on page 5 of the bill, and this notice requirement basically conforms to the changes that we're trying to make. Subdivision 4, lines 5.10 to 5.11 says that if somehow there should be a failure to give this notification, just because someone didn't get the notice doesn't mean their rights aren't restored. And I believe, Madam Chair members, that is the gist of the bill.
Senator Rest?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Moore, if this bill moves forward to the full committee, are you requesting it to come to the Judiciary Committee?
I will be requesting that, Madam Chair.
And so we would act on it, because I have another question with regard to, I mean, act on it quickly. With the obligations that you're, even if they've been mightily reduced, that you're putting on corrections and the Secretary of State's office, do you anticipate a fiscal note from either agency?
Well, I was hoping that by dramatically increasing it, that if there was a fiscal note, that it would be negligible. Mm-hmm. My sense is that in the process of discharging from incarceration, they're already engaging in a lot of the paperwork Already, I know from work with corrections, our corrections people do a great job at reentry efforts, and they have programs in place to help people obtain their driver's licenses, their Minnesota State ID card, getting their Social Security numbers, so that when they come out, they're able to fully function in the community. And I don't think that that by having them, we've already, as much as I don't like a prescribed notice in the law, I thought that by doing this, it in essence is just making a copy of that sheet, sticking it on a voter registration card, and giving it to the individual as part of the routine of the discharge process. So I hope that even if it is added responsibility, that it would be negligible and not incur a big fiscal note.
Senator Mwat, in section 4 of the bill, describing the duties of the Secretary of State?
Yes.
And maybe this is best answered by someone from the Secretary's office, but how much of this type of information do they already collect, or is this a big expansion of what the Secretary of State's office already needs to do?
Madam Chair, I have to admit that while I've been exchanging information electronically with the Secretary of State's office, I've not had a chance to speak to them. And if they're willing to come to the table to answer questions, I'd be happy to hear the response.
I see Ms. Frazier here. Ms. Frazier, welcome to the committee. We're referencing lines 2.26. through 2.33 of the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. Section 4 requiring us to develop information about voting rights of people who have previously been convicted of felonies. It's along the lines of information that we currently develop. We try to develop information for many different segments of the voting population and frequently asked questions, and this would not be out of the ordinary of the type of information that we do create.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions for the author or the testifier? Senator Rest?
Madam Chair, unless there's anyone else to testify, I'm prepared to make a motion.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 564? Senator Rest moves that Senate File 564 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rest. And Senator Mwat.
Madam Chair, members, I am now going to move to Senate File 763. There's an A2 amendment, a delete everything amendment that I'd like to have the committee consider to put the bill in the shape I would like it to be in.
Although we have not all members have seen the amendment yet, Senator Rest will move this amendment to get the bill in the shape you would like it, Senator Mwat. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Senator Mwat?
Madam Chair, members, the A2 amendment mimics the language change that we made to the good language change that we made to the previous Senate File 564. Senate File 564 is my preferred avenue to go about the restoration of civil rights. Representative Bobby Champion and the other body felt that it was important to provide alternatives. And so Senate File 763 doesn't go as far as Senate File 564. Senate File 763 basically takes current law, which is you get your voting rights restored after you're off papers. But it seeks to address some of the notice problems that were allowing our people who are eligible to vote to fall between the cracks. What you see here we've passed out to you is a sample of a letter from the court that gets sent to our ex-offenders when they've gone off papers. And you will see in this sample letter that we've given to you that There is a statement in here letting them know that their rights have been restored. But sometimes when you look at these court documents, it doesn't quite spell it out. And so what Senate File 763 does is that it takes current law as is, and then it puts into it the requirement to give the notice requirement that's exactly the same as in the other bill.
So this, Senator Moy, this just has the notice requirement provisions in this Senate file.
Right. So when you go off, Madam Chair and members, when you go off papers, what we're asking is for this notice to be put, to be sent out to notify them that their rights have been restored. And what is the same here? What we've changed in here, I think, is the informed plea section. And I didn't speak to that. In Section 3 of the bill, we ask that if somebody is going to be in a plea bargain type situation, and if they're going to be potentially agreeing to a plea for a felony level offense, we would like them, again, as part of the arraignment process, you know, I think there's a form where they are given caveats and notices up front. We would like to be added to that arraignment process, this notice that if you plead to a felony level offense, you in essence are foregoing your right to vote. And we would like to be added to the plea process.
And Senator Moy, just like the previous bill, I assume that you will request after this, if this bill moves through state and local, you would like it to go to the Judiciary Committee?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas?
Senator Moy, on that Section 3 notice, shouldn't you also say, because it sounds like it's forever and ever, so shouldn't you say you're losing your civil rights, your right to vote, during the course of your sentence and probationary period?
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, I think that's a very good addition. And if you'd like to offer an oral amendment, I would consider that a friendly amendment.
Mr. Bodden, do you want to help me with the language? That would be good.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, on page 2, line 10, before the period, you could insert, until the defendant's sentence has been discharged.
I'll make that amendment.
Senator Pappas moves the oral amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thanks. Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair and Senator Moy, I do have one question. I had a chance to, in December, I spent a day in one of the courts in my district. And honestly, watching the behavior of some of the people sentenced and those kinds of things, I think this was the farthest thing from their mind. So I understand there's a ton of paperwork they sign off on and all that. So I'm just kind of trying to get where you're at on, you know, is this maybe the most appropriate time for them to get this? I mean, they're thinking about, I'm going to go to jail for 3 years. You know, I could care less about if I'm voting or not. So I'm just wondering if there might be a more appropriate time for them to receive something like that.
They said it twice.
Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, thank you for your question. I agree. I mean, there are a lot of things going on at that time. But in a plea bargain kind of a situation, I'm assuming that you have an attorney and the individual should have the opportunity to consider what all the consequences are when they're pleading to something. And so this is part of being informed about what you're pleading to and what you're willing to give up as part of that plea. And in the process, you know, I was trying to think about if there was a better time to give the information, and I think that that's probably the most appropriate, the most cost-effective place to do it, because it's already part of the process without creating yet another layer of bureaucracy. Plus, I also think that it is important to, at the time when the individual is considering his or her alternatives, that oftentimes people aren't made aware of what some of the collateral and adverse consequences are for their actions. And maybe this is, whether the person is necessarily thinking about all the consequences or not, it's an opportunity for a teaching moment to say, given what you have done and what you're about to do, this is one of the things that is highly valued by many people that you're going to lose if you enter into this plea. So that it is an informed plea, and that if the person willingly takes that plea, then they willingly give up this valuable privilege that we have. I'm not sure that it would necessarily, be the thing that triggers a person to not want to go into the plea. But certainly I see it as a teaching moment to say this is yet one of those privileges that you lose as a part of the criminal process.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 763? Senator Rest moves that Senate File 763 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Moy and those of you who spoke on this bill, thank you very much for coming here today. Senator Rest, would you like to do 425 first? That's the...
Yes. Yeah, in the order here on the agenda. Madam Chair, Senate File 425 is a proposal coming to us from the Campaign Finance Board. As you know, our committee is not only has jurisdiction over and oversight over election law, but also over the campaign finance statutes as well. We have had Senator Shive's bill, which deals with Chapter 10A. We've had, we have this bill, we'll have the following bill. Well, I guess that one's not in 10A, but, and we will have an additional bill coming, making some, that I have also making some additional changes with regard to legislative candidates and actually in statewide candidates as well. Last fall, Senator Gerlach and I, and I believe there was someone there from the House, met with the Campaign Finance Board at a public part of their meeting and discussed with them some possible changes and issues that they had encountered and invited them to send recommendations to us for some legislation. And what the result of that is Senate File 425. If you just take a look at the overview, the bill contains some rationalization of some parts of the campaign finance law, responds to some Supreme Court decisions, and adds some additional requirements eventually for candidates. The first one is, if you look at the summary, is the repeal and deletion of some of the provisions in our statutes that have been held unconstitutional and are no longer enforced by the board, and they have to deal with, for the most part, independent expenditures, which we have not been able to get our arms around in a meaningful way that does not result in being thrown out by the Supreme Court. So as a response to some of those decisions, they're being those provisions are being taken out. Secondly, is removal of a requirement, which would have a slight fiscal impact of
requirement for an initial notice by certified mail when candidates and affiliated entities fail to meet filing deadlines. Also, will be an additional requirement now when you're filling out information for the board to provide an email address, either the principal campaign officer and or the candidate, with the reservation being given to the board to provide an exemption for that requirement for good cause. Secondly, we've addressed this issue before, but we have now some additional clarifying information about the dollar amount, resale dollar amount of $5, which is what it is in for other things that candidates or elected officials receive, to have that rather than immaterial value, that it be set at a dollar value of $5. And then we continue to have some problem with conflicting language in the statutes for the timing for filing an affidavit of contributions, and also having distributions of the public subsidy. And in particular, I would direct your attention to Section 12, which would require the filing of the pre-primary election report with the board before the board makes any public subsidy payment to an otherwise qualified candidate. So it is it's a compliance issue with that is followed by a I don't know whether it's a carrot or a stick here, but you don't get the money unless you play by the rules. And then there were some timing issues with regard to the filing of a public subsidy agreement and the accompanying affidavit of contributions for special elections that needed to be clarified and made consistent with the policies that we are that we have in the other in those elections which are not special elections. And the Section 15, I'm going to ask Mr. Goldsmith, who is the executive director of the Campaign Finance Board, to explain. There is a ban on the commercial use of information copied from reports and statements that are filed with them. They're a commercial use, not a political use or for elections or anything. And they are requesting that they exempt the reports and statements that are filed by lobbyists and to allow their use for a commercial purpose. And I confess I don't know why exactly that would be the case. We do have another requirement in here is to provide for electronic filing for the for our reports, and we want to make that we need a that's in Section 9, and we want to make that the rest of the bill would the effective date would be August 1st because there is no effective date, but the effective date for the filing electronically, we want it to be for 2012.
Senator Rest, we have this amendment.
We have that amendment.
It's being distributed.
And that would be,
my Senator
amendment,
Rest
first
moves.
Of all, to have that that clear that we're not requiring all of that to happen as of, well, it would be as of January 31st of 2010, but which would be the next filing, but for unless there's a special election, but for 2012.
Wow.
And the reason for that particular date, which I support. I mean, why so far out? Well, what we did, we have heard in previous discussions that it tends to be candidates who have been around for a long time prior to the possibility of electronic filing who have kept to non-electronic filing. But the vast majority of candidates who are more recent candidates do use electronic filing. 2012 is generally a watershed year, or that year in every decade is a watershed year for retirements. And so we would think that a lot of people, or not a lot, but at least a significant number of people who have been in the legislature for some time would not file for re-election, and that might also be an easier time period for to put into place electronic filing. But the board is also given discretion there for good cause to exempt someone from having to file electronically. Senator, so that is basically the bill, and I would move the A1 amendment.
Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
And then, Madam Chair, I hope you'll give Mr. Goldsmith some opportunity to also explain the board's position on these issues.
Mr. Goldsmith, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Gary Goldsmith, Executive Director for the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board. Members, it's an honor to appear before you today. I was appointed the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance Board actually on December 24th of not this past, but 1 year ago. So I've been the Executive Director for a little over a year, although I had 5 years of previous experience as the Assistant Director. Coming to the board, I see many opportunities, many of them related to technology, and many of them that will allow the board to meet the governor's request and certainly the legislature's request to become more efficient and to contain our costs. The board essentially is a data management organization. We collect data, we assemble it, we publish it, and then we enforce statutory requirements based on that data, or in some cases based on the failure of a party to file that data. So we're looking at ways that we can improve our ability to do that with fewer staff. No matter how the budget comes out this coming year, we know that we're going to be down from a traditional staff of 9 to at most 8. It's our goal to stay at 8. So we have to find technology solutions, and we're making good progress on doing that. This bill takes us some incremental steps in that direction. With regard to efficiency and cost control, the bill takes one small step by allowing us to collect email addresses from candidates and treasurers of principal campaign committees. Right now, we do that on a voluntary basis, but we don't have the right to collect those in any enforceable way. Now, we recognize the realities of the world. We recognize that not everybody has a computer, not everybody has email, not everybody has the internet. And so there is a provision in the bill that says the board can waive this email provision requirement for good cause. And I want members to be sure to understand that good cause doesn't mean you have to have the greatest, best reason in the world. Some courts have said good cause and cause are the same thing. In other words, you do have to have a reason if you don't want to have your email provided to the board. And one reason would be I don't have one. That would be sufficient, or I don't have a computer. This is step one, because it then allows us to assess the ability of the board to obtain email addresses, the range of email addresses, and begin to develop a plan for how we then can begin to distribute materials that are distributed by paper now, maybe optionally distributed by the board through our educational efforts, and we may be able to start distributing some of those materials by email. So this is just the first step in what will be an incremental series of ways to move from paper to electronic documents in some areas of the board's business. Another step, which is, I think, more than incremental, but really, again, because of the good clause waiver provision, another step toward efficiency and cost control is the electronic filing requirement that Senator Rest mentioned. And I want members to
clearly understand and make sure that your colleagues who talk to you understand. When the statute says that a campaign finance report must be filed in an electronic format approved by the board, that does not mean that you have to use the software that the board provides. We have a plan in development. It's already a fair ways along, but it will be much further along in the next year or so. And it includes several things. First of all, the board will actually be publishing an open standard for an electronic report. So if you're using Trailblazer, or if your party unit using Aristotle, or any other commercial software, those vendors will easily be able to comply with this requirement using their own software. If you have an IT person who does your own, even in Excel, we expect you'll be able to generate an electronic report in the format that would meet the board's requirements. So it's not that you have to use our software or any particular software. It's that you put the data into a form that we can absorb into our database efficiently and easily. There's a good cause waiver provision in this statute as well. And again, we realize that treasurers are a valued asset to every committee and that some treasurers have been around doing their job for a committee for a long time. We recognize that they're typically volunteers. And so this statute is not intended, and the board would not require a treasurer who doesn't have a computer and has not used one to go out and learn to use one or to buy one. That would be good cause not to file electronically in any form. They would be able to still file in paper. Likewise, if a committee is very small and some small party units or independent units or even some candidate committees are very small, there is a learning curve or a development curve to any kind of electronic transition. And so there has to be some cost-benefit analysis. And if your committee is so small that there isn't value in moving to an electronic format, that would be good cause. Prior to 2012, the board will publish some guidance on this, so you'll be able to follow this over the next few years to see the direction the board's going. But I think what we want you to understand is that while it is a compulsory electronic filing, it isn't going to be dumped on every candidate and every committee right at the beginning of 2012 and say change or you're in violation. That's not our intent. We did some research at Senator Rest's request, and we found something very interesting with regard to candidate committees. Committees that are registered with the board today, there are 146 that were registered in or before the year 2000. And of those, only 17% or 25 use our software. From 2001 to 2008, of committees who are registered now, 694 of them registered after January 1 of 2001, and 34%, almost 35%, in other words, twice as many in percentage terms use the software voluntarily, 242 users. So not only is the percentage double, but the number of users is almost 10 times because more committees registered late. Using the 2012 mandatory date, I think we will have a very high percentage of people who are able to use electronic filing already on board at that time. So I don't want people to be concerned that this is going to necessarily change your method of operation or that if it does, it will be a painful change. I will certainly take questions, and I'm willing to talk to anybody anywhere about these issues. Another provision, and actually it appears five different places in the bill, is the elimination of a certified letter to start a late filing fee accruing. Let me tell you, first of all, about late filing fees. They don't start until 5 days after a report is due. And when they do start, they are $5 a day, and they only go up to $100. Now, the board at this point is not suggesting that be changed. The financial incentive to file on time is minimal, whereas the political incentive is fairly significant. People don't want to be filing late. So we're not, the statute isn't doing this to make money, and of course the money goes to the general fund of the state, not the board anyway. But to even trigger that $5 late filing fee, the board has to send a certified letter to each person who hasn't filed on time. In the last election year, 2006, we sent 1,700 certified letters to late filers at a cost of something in excess of $2,500. Now, the savings is not terribly significant, but with the board, even a few thousand dollars here and there does make a difference. Instead of doing the certified letter, or actually right now, in addition to doing the certified letter, we have an aggressive telephone calling campaign. And so if a candidate is late in filing, the treasurer will get a call from us and will make contact prior to the date that we would normally send the certified letter. By doing that, we've got the number of letters down from where they used to be. Right now, we're at the point where we would be sending a second certified letter for campaign finance reports. We have about 60 still who have not filed. And we're calling both the candidate and the treasurer this time to try to make sure we can reach a person to talk to let them know that they're already late and that another letter is going to come out. Even if we delete this first certified letter, there will be a certified letter about 2 weeks after the report is due, and that would trigger some additional penalties at the rate of $100 a week. So there's a little more significant penalty, but there would still be a certified letter before that would be triggered. There are a couple of significant things that I think are a little bit more than just administrative. Senator Rest mentioned one of them, and that is, let me check which section it is. Section 12, called withholding of public subsidy. There are two requirements, well, actually there are several requirements, but the two key requirements to get public subsidy money are, number one, you file an affidavit indicating that you've raised a certain level of qualifying contributions that are specified in statute. And number two, of course, you sign a public subsidy agreement. In the last session, the legislature modified the timing of these documents so that what is on that affidavit saying I raised these qualifying contributions, the time period covered by that affidavit is the same as the time period covered by the first report, the pre-primary report. And the reason we did that was so not only would we have the affidavit, but we'd have a report that would show at least that much money coming in, and also presumably, if this is a real candidate raising money, presumably would show some expenditures. And the reason we wanted to see that is because in the past we've received affidavits, paid public subsidy, and then got the report in later showing either that they didn't raise the money or they say they raised it, but there was no spending, and it raises a level of suspicion. What happened in the last election was one candidate, only one, had filed an affidavit of contributions saying that this person had raised the contributions and did not file a pre-primary report. Now, the pre-primary report is due 2 weeks before the primary election, so we had lots of communication with this candidate because public subsidy isn't paid until 1 week after, so there's a three-week period to get the report in. And this candidate kept promising and had problem after problem and did not get the report in. The board was concerned that this candidate maybe hadn't really raised the money that was shown in the affidavit. We felt we needed some additional assurance of that other than the candidate saying she'd get the report in. And actually, the board did defer payment of that one person's public subsidy. And the person did then, a couple of weeks later, get the report in. We were able to verify spending, and the person did get payment of the public subsidy. So this provision in Section 12 doesn't preclude, it's not a condition of getting public subsidy, but it says that you have to file that pre-primary report showing your expenses and receipts before we're going to give out this state payment of money. Now, there is a little bit harsher penalty at the end, and that says that if you don't file that report by the general election, which, as you know, is another 6 weeks later, if you still haven't filed any report with the board, you're going to forfeit your public subsidy as a result of that. There is a technical correction regarding public subsidy. That would be Section 14 and Section 13. I'm sorry. Yeah, Section 13 and 14, these relate only to special elections, so they have no effect on what you do normally with your committee. In a special election, a candidate has to file a new public subsidy agreement and has to raise qualifying contributions within a specified period. Under the current law, the date by which you do those two things is governed by when you file your affidavit of candidacy for that special election. And one day later, you have to file a public subsidy agreement, and 5 days later than that, you have to have completed raising your qualifying contributions. What happened in two special elections in 2007 was that people who were not familiar with the system and didn't have sufficient guidance from their party, or maybe none because they hadn't contacted the party, people were excited to run in a special election, and they went in on the first day of the special election and filed for office. They got their packet from the board at that time, and they realized immediately that by tomorrow you must file your public subsidy agreement. That's not such a problem. That's just signing the agreement. But reading a little further, they realized that they only had then 5 days to raise $1,500, counting only the first $50 per person. And some people tried to do it and found out they weren't going to be able to. They also realized that people who waited till the last day to file had the whole filing period plus the 5 days that would run after they filed, so a couple of extra weeks. Several candidates actually withdrew their affidavit of candidacy, so it was no longer effective, refiled on the last day so that the effective date of the affidavit of candidacy gave them that additional time to raise the qualifying contributions. Sorry to make that long explanation. To make a short conclusion, these two provisions would simply say that the date to file an affidavit of contributions and your public subsidy agreement run from the last day of filings, regardless of whether you filed on that last day or filed earlier in the period. So everybody has the same time period to file the public subsidy agreement and to raise the qualifying contributions. It's still 5 days after the filing date, so it doesn't extend things significantly, but it puts everybody on the same footing without making them withdraw their affidavit of candidacy.
Section 15.
Oh, yeah, Senator Rest asked me to address Section 15, and I think in our board recommendations that was provided to Mr. Bodden, we may not have provided the background for that. This isn't something the board came up with, actually. As Senator Rest indicates, for a long time, commercial use of our information has been prohibited. In 1998, in the case of St. Paul Legal Ledger versus the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board, the Ramsey County District Court, not a Supreme Court decision, but the Ramsey County District Court concluded that this restriction on commercial use as it applied to lobbyist data was unconstitutional and restrained the board from further enforcement of that provision as related to lobbyist data. We don't know what would have happened if they'd also been looking for candidate data, but they wouldn't. So the statute, the board for, since 1998 has not been allowed to apply that with regard to lobbyist data, and so that little exception is added into the statute so that we don't have to explain that. We have signs posted in the office and on our website, but that just makes the statute now conform to what the permanent injunction against the board is. There are some other provisions, but I think that they're relatively clear, and I will be happy to address any questions or concerns that members might have.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Goldsmith, that last provision, I'm curious I don't remember that court case, but what was somebody trying to use reports and statements filed by lobbyists and lobbyist principals for commercial purposes? Put together a directory or?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, members, I don't recall specifically either if it was a directory or if it was simply to attempt to sell subscriptions to this group of people, but they were accumulating names and addresses of lobbyists and principals is what they were doing. And
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Goldsmith, with the court case on independent expenditures, or I guess there were several of them, I can't remember the details, but one of them was explicitly on the repealed section, namely that we could not require somebody making an independent expenditure to notify within 24 hours what they were doing, right?
Correct.
And I remember the 98 or whatever year it was, the case where they said we could not ban independent expenditures by political party. And in Section 1, I'm wondering, the fact that we can't ban them from doing them doesn't mean we shouldn't, we should not change the reality of what some situation is. And here the definition of independent expenditure explicitly says that an expenditure by a political party or political party unit in a race where they have a candidate on the ballot is not an independent expenditure. And I would argue when I read the definition of independent expenditure, it clearly is one, even if the court says we cannot ban them from making them. I'm not sure if there's any other, I'm not sure how the independent expenditure language, I can't think in my mind right now how we're using it, but what's the problem? I mean, is there a problem leaving that in there, first of all?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, members, yes, there is. Actually, if you read the statute with the stricken line out, the definition of independent expenditure remains as it is and as it has been since 1999, which means that independent expenditures by party units are, in fact, independent expenditures just like those made by anyone else. The effect of the line that's dropped out is the legislature or the state was making a presumption that if you had a candidate on the ballot, and the board said that meant after the nominating convention or after the primary, if there was one, that if you had a candidate on the ballot, no matter what the party unit did, as far as putting up a wall between candidates and party unit members and keeping all contact, avoiding all contact, no matter what they did, it would still not be considered independent. So the effect of this is to say, regardless of whether it would otherwise be independent, if you have a candidate on the ballot and you're a party unit, it's not. And the court said that the state did not provide any basis for making that presumption and that without actual proof of collaboration or collusion, party units could, in fact, make independent expenditures even when they had candidates on the ballot. The effect of the provision was essentially to say that party units were incapable under any circumstance of making independent expenditures once they had a candidate on the ballot.
And
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Goldsmith, so the ruling was by the court was not saying there never, I mean, I remember a 98 case or so where I think it was federal court, they decided that we could not ban parties from making independent expenditures. But the ruling you're talking about is one that says we cannot, that this statement itself is unconstitutional because there is, in theory, a way that you could make one that truly did not meet our definition of independent expenditure.
Or Madam Chair, I mean, I think Senator Marty is saying simply because a party has a candidate on the ballot, that does not mean that they are incapable of making an independent expenditure.
And Madam Chair, Senator Rest, I realize that that's what it's saying, and I think that that's a fair statement to say because I don't see how in the world a party can make a, quote, independent expenditure on behalf of a candidate that they are, I mean, it's just the natural, the reality is that they're so intertwined that it is not, that maybe it's with a wink and a nod and so on that people decide to do certain expenditures, but I guess I think the statement is accurate, and I'm wondering what the court, what's the impact of, is there any impact of taking this out here because, in other words, is there an impact to taking this out? Not based on whether the court is right that we can't make that presumption. Are they saying explicitly this definition has to come out, or they're saying that we can't enforce anything against the parties for making one of those non-independent expenditures, which they would say might well be independent?
Mr. Goldsmith,
I think the latter.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I think we're actually talking about the same case because this language, sentence that will be stricken essentially does ban independent expenditures by saying once you know your candidates, your spending is not independent, period. It's a presumption. And so it was considered to be a ban on independent expenditures, and the court said the state had not provided a basis to determine that it was, in fact, impossible to make an independent expenditure by a political party. In other words, it would be up to the board to find actual evidence that there was some collaboration to make it a campaign expenditure. The effect of the sentence as in the statute was to say all party spending is attributable to the candidate either as an approved expenditure or a contribution, and there was no such thing as an independent expenditure. Whether it's left in or out will have no bearing because the board is permanently enjoined from enforcing that provision. And so it's the reason we suggest taking it out is to clarify the statute and avoid answering questions. I think that the court's position so far is that if we can show that there's collaboration, certainly we will say it's not an independent expenditure. And if we cannot show that, and the party units can show that there was a wall between them, they may make independent expenditures. The only way to actually prevent that would be by some sort of an agreement, which would have to be somehow tied to public subsidy or some other compensation, I think.
So Madam Chair, Mr. Goldsmith, the situation where this would have an impact, so it is a substantive change that's required. I mean, it's not enforced now. You're enjoined from enforcing it. But the impact of this definition here is whether an expenditure by the party, not that they can't make them, but right now an expenditure by a party, which they're allowed to make, it's whether they have to report it as a in-kind contribution to the candidate or not. And you could go in and say this is not truly an independent expenditure and therefore this must be reported that way. The only thing is you cannot have the presumption.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, members, that's absolutely correct. In fact, the board had a very, very detailed investigation during the 2006 election on an allegation that there was collaboration between a candidate and a caucus party unit. I actually conducted that investigation. We conducted interviews. We looked at emails. And in the end, we were not able to provide sufficient evidence to find that level of collaboration that was necessary. But yes, the board could challenge an independent expenditure, and if a complaint were filed, the board would investigate that kind of complaint.
And, Madam Chair, one final thing. I'm trying to understand this. That same federal court ruling, they also did say that parties are allowed to do independent expenditures. I mean, so there was two parts of it, one of which is they're allowed to do independent expenditures, and number two, you can't presume that anything they're doing is not independent.
Mr.
Chair, Senator Marty, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 425? Senator Rest moves that Senate File 425 as amended. No, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you,
Mr. Goldsmith. Senator Rest, your next bill is on the calendar is Senate File 80.
Yes, Madam Chair. Last year when I started working with Minnesotans for an Impartial Independent Judiciary, I can't remember exactly what the title of the group is, and we were looking at changing the way in which Minnesotans selected their judges, we also discovered that alone among people running for statewide office or countywide or districtwide, that judicial candidates did not have a contribution limit. And so we had a proposal last year, actually, besides the one for performance evaluations and retention elections, which if the Judiciary Committee acts favorably on that proposal on Monday, it was canceled from last night because of the storm, but it will be on there Monday. This committee would then take a look at that proposal. we proposed that, similar to other candidates, regardless of the system under which they are elected, that candidates for judicial office be subject to a contribution limit as well. And this is in the campaign finance statute. It is in 10A, and the level is set at $2,000 in an election year for the office sought and $500 in other years. And that coincides with current law for candidates for governor and lieutenant governor. Interestingly enough, and I didn't know it at the time, but in December, the state Supreme Court put in place with their judicial, I don't know, canons, whatever, for people running for office, they also put this limit in of $2,000. I don't know whether they put in the additional qualification of $500 in a, quote, non-election year. But clearly, the Supreme Court thought that this was an issue that ought to also be addressed. So the question arises, it seems to me, whether the legislature thinks that it's important to have that in statute, or whether we would just let the Supreme Court in its canons for the conducting judicial candidates conducting themselves as they're running for office. And I believe that just as we would not permit the legislature to impose outside of statutes its own contribution limits or those running for statewide office, a governor, lieutenant governor, the other constitutional officers to get together and decide on contribution limits outside of putting them in the statutes, that it is appropriate that we also have it in the statute. So the bill is pretty simple, straightforward, and I hope that you will support it. And I'm pleased to have Senator Gimsey as a co-author.
Is there anyone, excuse me, is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify on Senate File 80? Senator Ress moves that Senate File 80 be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Ress, Senate File 791.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 791, which I'm joined in the Senate and by Senator Michelle as a co-author, is a bill that is a response to the situation in which the state found itself in 2008 with the election for U.S. Senator that occasioned a recount because it met the statutory requirement for an automatic recount, which is 0.5% of those voting, and there were about 3 million voters, and that threshold was 15,000, and the election showed I don't remember the exact number, but a difference between the top two candidates of 700 to 800 votes, and then there was significant drop-off between the top two. With conversations with Representative Broad, she and I decided that it was worth putting forward a proposal that instead of having a recount for specific elections, and that is statewide ones, only statewide ones, that better to let the people reaffirm their decision in that race and to call for a special election.
It is done in a number of other states where there is a close vote. In some states, Louisiana being one, they require a runoff election regardless if a candidate does not achieve 50% plus one of the ballots cast. So they sometimes have them and sometimes they don't. We also make a proposal to change the level at which a runoff election would be triggered from a half of 1% to 1/8 of 1%. And in the current election, that would have brought the number down to like 3,000 votes, something like that. And the reason for that came about from the testimony that we heard about the accuracy of Minnesota's voting machines, and that within in the recount activities, that time and time again, the accuracy of the voting machines was 95%, 99%, and that we did not need to have, particularly in statewide races with a huge number of people voting, that we did not need to have that high or that low a threshold to trigger a runoff election. Whether that number should be 1/8 or 1/4, I think that a number of people, not all, by the way, but a number of people think that that threshold should be reduced. There are some that think it should stay where it is, and the reason for that is the statistical analysis that a person is doing that is providing it to me that is indicating that that you need that big a number in order to verify the accuracy of the voting machines, and that we should be cautious about reducing it. Now, I've only seen his rationale for that, rather than actually seeing the statistics. So, I'm not sure whether that's the right way to move in this at all. So that's basically what the bill does, and then it sets into place how you'd go about doing it, and it calls for that runoff election to be held no more than 30 days after the canvassing board has indicated that threshold has been met that would, under current law, occasion a recount. Obviously, having a separate election, as in any other special election, and this runoff election would be conducted as if it were a special election, costs money. And one of the and some offer a opposition to the bill because of its cost, although we haven't had many races, statewide races, in Minnesota's history that have been that close. So one has to ask, well, is it worthwhile to have the people of the state fully engaged in the integrity of our election system on those rare occasions in which there is this closeness, to have to verify that and to have to make sure we have the confidence in that by having a runoff election or not. And that's a policy question that the the legislature would need to answer, and I and my answer and Representative Broad's answer is yes. The current system, which Secretary of State undertook in the 2008 election, also, unlike previous ones, called for the recount not to be done in a central location but to be done locally, and rightfully made the claim that that brought the cost of the recount itself to a much lower amount. However, what we have observed and what we are continuing to observe in the courts is a localized, what appears to be a localized application of statutory criteria for whether a vote is to be counted or not. And I would claim that even if it costs more to have had the recount in a central location where the application of the criteria of whether to count as, and I don't mean the counting of, not the challenging of a ballot to start with, but whether a ballot, the absentee ballots in particular, were going to be consistently, the criterion was going to be consistently applied, that we would have avoided that. And that obviously is one of the big issues in the contest. We have a, and so I would offer the runoff election itself as a way of solving that. In addition, the unlikely result, and it certainly is one that could be, is that the top two, or if by some really strange result, the three candidates would have, or four candidates would have, a difference between all of them of this less than 1/8 of 1%, that the runoff election, special election, would be between more than two candidates. I think that's highly unlikely, but theoretically possible, as well as the runoff election itself having a ending up in a difference in the or an almost equal number of votes being cast for one candidate as for the other. At that point, if that did happen, the election would become would be decided by an election contest. Also, it's my understanding that in the previous recount of a statewide election, that's how the actual recount itself was done, not a certification by the canvassing board and then an election contest where the votes were, in a sense, recounted, but all of the counting was done under the inside the court situation. So that is what this bill is being offered as a response to. There are some that don't understand why a Democrat is proposing this legislation, because across the country, when there are runoff elections, they are routinely won by, or I don't know if routinely, more often than otherwise, run by Republicans, because Democrats do not get out and vote that second time. I think that is a very cynical reason to oppose this particular provision, and I was happy to see that Speaker Anderson, Kelleher, thought that this was a good approach to a very rare situation, and she signed on to Representative Broad's bill. I think if Democrats want to run elections, they have to get out the vote for their candidates under any circumstances. So I don't
Senator
think that,
Rest,
that's
and,
a good
and to that
good
point,
point.
The fact that you lessen the requirement of the difference between two candidates from 1/2 of a percent down to 1/8 of a percent certainly brings more comfort to me because the likelihood of a runoff occurring would be lessened, and it would only happen in these very rare circumstances where the differences between candidates is indeed very narrow.
And you know, and I would thought that, for example, if the we would be having a recount right now, even if it was at 1/8%. But if Senator Coleman had been ahead by 12,000 votes, I don't think that should have occasioned an automatic recount, and it certainly would have under our current law. And I think we need to, even if we didn't go to a runoff election, that we need to revisit that percentage. And Madam Chair, I believe I have a technical author's amendment.
Correct. The A1 amendment just makes conforming changes that you described. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. The motion's adopted. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, I noticed the last subdivision says that if this recount is close, we don't have another, if the runoff is close, we don't have another runoff of the runoff. I presume, and I can understand the reason for that, namely that certain point people are just getting tired of elections and how many elections are we going to have, because assuming the first race is close enough to have a runoff in your scenario, and I think most states they have runoffs, I thought they were not because the races were close, but because somebody didn't have a majority of the vote, there was a plurality instead. But in the idea of having a runoff to, because we're not sure we can count the ballots accurately, it just seems like, if the race is that close, a runoff, there's a decent chance the runoff will be close, and statistically speaking, it's not that likely. We're not going to have a runoff of a runoff every time, but I'm just curious of your logic behind the no recount, because people are just sick of elections at some point, and even if the vote count isn't that precise there, we're just going to live with it, or?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I think, number one, one point is that there should be an obligation within the system to enhance the voters' confidence in the election, and that and we have heard claims about all votes being counted and et cetera, and that in a recount election, those folks who voted for a third candidate or a fourth candidate or a fifth candidate, they're not involved in the recount, obviously. And what would happen with a runoff election is, assuming that the most likely scenario is two people, that they would have an opportunity to cast a vote for one of those persons and be engaged in the situation or in the election. Another point is if we had had a runoff election and one of the candidates won by 15,000 votes in this last election, I would doubt very, very seriously that anyone would have attempted an election contest. And we would right now be represented either by Senator Coleman or by Al Franken in the United States Senate. And we are in a period of economic collapse and turmoil. And as much as I respect Senator Klobuchar, I don't think that Minnesota is well served by not having a second U.S. senator already in office acting on our behalf. And the recount lengthens that time, and we would have a decision by the first week in December if we had a runoff election that otherwise wasn't going to be contested, like the one is that we have now.
Madam Chair, I don't see how that relates to Subdivision 4, however, because frankly, if we had a recount this year and the re-election, the runoff election this year, and it was close, we'd still be counting. We'd be 2 months further behind in the counting, however. So, I mean, well,
there would be an election contest.
Senator Marty, I think in the amendment we just passed, Subdivision 4 was deleted.
So, in other words, we would have a runoff if it was a close race.
No.
Senator.
You'd have,
Senator West.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, you'd have an election, and then if there was, say, a difference of 800 votes in the statewide election, there would be a runoff election that would be conducted first week in December. And if that election was also determined that it neither one of the two candidates won by more than whatever that 1/8 of 1%, that there would be an election contest, and that the issue would then go directly to the courts like it used to do before we changed the law to allow the administrative recount to occur first.
Senator Ress, Mr. Bonner has one small technical amendment.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, Subdivision 4 was removed in the technical amendment because it appears to be redundant, and it would be with respect to the automatic recount, since this bill takes these races out of the provisions for an automatic recount. One thing it did pick up that may have been inadvertently removed, it would also have eliminated a discretionary recount, and I'm not certain what your intentions were in that regard. We can very easily include that if you want.
Senator Rest?
Well, I guess I don't want to include. I think it muddies the water of the issue of moving to a runoff election as opposed to dealing with recounts on statewide races that close. But they always have the opportunity to have to go to an election contest, and that would be discretionary. So I don't think we need the discretionary runoff request here, unless I'm misunderstanding your point.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, the effect of removing this language would be to the way the technical amendment worked, it took out all of Section 240C.35, which provides for the automatic recount and the discretionary recount. And if you wish, you could add language specifying, and because of the way the bill is worded, the automatic recount would not apply without that language. What you may want to do is add a sentence clarifying that a candidate cannot request a discretionary recount.
Madam Chair, that's what I would request.
Okay, then, Madam Chair, the suggested amendment would be you would retain the headnote for that subdivision and add a sentence that says Section 204C.35, Subdivision 2, does not apply to an election under this section.
Mr. Bottom, could you repeat that, please?
Certainly. On page 3, line 27 of the bill, you would retain the headnote, Subdivision 4, no recount, and add a sentence that would read, and I'll remind, you keep in place deleting lines 3.27 through 3.30 and simply have a sentence that reads, Section 204C.35, Subdivision 2, does not apply to an election under this section.
Senator Rest moves that language. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, maybe it's just a comment about the bill. The last U.S. Senate race in Minnesota, this one last year, was, I think I heard numbers of over $50 million spent on the race. I'd care to bet that if we had a runoff in that case, there'd probably be $50 million more spent on it, dumped in from all around the country, because it's a key seat. Once we know the rest of the makeup of the Senate and there are no other races going on at the same time, I'm not sure that that does, Senator Rest, what you said about increasing voter confidence in the system. And I think people would regret that we had it if we have it.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 791?
Yeah,
One of my former friends.
Yes. Former Senator Pottinger.
Take out all the nice things I said about Senator Reston. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the subcommittee. Good morning. I'm John Hottinger. I live in St. Paul, and I'm here as a volunteer member of the Fair Vote Minnesota Board. Fair Vote Minnesota is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization which works for better democracy through a unique focus on the voting system. We educate the public about the effect our voting system has on the quality of our democracy and about alternative voting systems that may improve public life. First, I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for the extensive hearings you've held on election issues this year, and thank Senator Rest for her leadership and encouraging thoughtful discussion of various options for improving elections for the citizens of Minnesota. I know Senator Rest realizes that no one in this building has more respect for her commitment, her intellect, her leadership, and her integrity. We've been friends and allies for a long time in important battles to serve Minnesota, all of which makes me really uncomfortable to be here in opposition to Senate File 791. But as a board member of Fair Vote, it's my responsibility. The nano-closeness of the U.S. Senate race has sparked calls to examine our election system, and they've been served well by the various ideas that have been introduced in this subcommittee and in both houses of the legislature. Senator Rest's testimony just done has suggested a variety of things that need to be considered as we do a nip and tuck on how election contests and how close elections are resolved in Minnesota, and I hope the committee listens to not only these bills but the suggestions you hear during testimony. But two issues have risen to particular emphasis in this discussion triggered by the U.S. Senate race. Number one, how can we assure that a candidate with majority support wins? And number two, how do we resolve elections, which are mathematical dead heat? Senator Est's bill calls for a later runoff election in the case of a general election for statewide office where the difference between two candidates is less than 1/8 of 1%. I think there would be no automatic recounts nor any discretionary recounts, as I understand the amendment that was offered. Fair Vote Minnesota opposes this proposal because it will result in an approach to a runoff election which leads to, number one, a dramatic drop in voter participation and thereby voter disenfranchisement from the final result. Number two, an increased expense to the state, including additional subsidies to candidates if the race is for state constitutional office. And number three, and I don't think Minnesotans want even more prolonged campaigns, which are already very long. We do, however, agree with the value of runoff elections where the initial election results in less than majority support for the leading candidate. And as Senator Marty pointed out in his comments, that's where other states use runoff elections in statewide races. And by the way, there's only one state that uses runoff elections for the final decision, and that is Georgia. Other states use it in primary situations. It's important to have majority support because it ensures that winners in a single-seat race can legitimately claim they have won their office with the support of a majority of the voters. Runoff elections would also reduce, although not eliminate, the likelihood of recounts. Runoffs after the general election, however, are not the answer. We don't believe Minnesotans would like to see political campaigns go on even longer. Most of us would like the decision made based on the voters who turned out on Election Day in November, when turnout is greatest, campaigns have come to an end, and we've made the vast public expenditure to run the elections. A very brief examination of runoff elections nationally. Number one, as I indicated, only Georgia uses them to make the final decision, other than in situations where there is a, well, only Georgia makes them to make the final decision. Otherwise, they're used in primaries. Historically, they were used in other southern states, and frankly, they were used to make sure the Democrats won in the whole solid South, and they were used, frankly, to make sure African Americans didn't win. That's changed. Now the Republicans win the runoffs in the South, and that's one way of guarantee that continues. So it has worked to both parties' advantages over the year. Here we have a competitive state. We will have competitive elections. But we also have to have the number of voters who make those final decisions certainly as high as on Election Day. So a better way than a second and expensive runoff election in late November or December is an instant runoff election, which allows voters on Election Day to rank candidates in order of preference, first choice, second choice, third choice. It's a tested and accepted approach that rolls two elections into one. By capturing voters' additional preferences on the general election ballot, we eliminate the need to ask voters to endure even more campaign commercials, make a second trip to the polls, and a second trip, which history shows, don't make for a good turnout. For instance, there was a recent Georgia statewide runoff for the U.S. Senate seat that was very close. Just 59% of the people who voted in the general election showed up for the runoff. 41% of the people who showed up in the general election day when they expect to show up, when they have presidents to vote for and members of Congress to vote for and their local officials to vote for, 41% of them didn't show up for that runoff. Since 2000, in other states which use runoffs, that is the primaries runoffs, the average turnout is 35% less than in the election of which that is a runoff. In Minnesota this year, the Senate race would have likely been decided and should have been decided by the tremendous turnout of voters on Election Day, instead of us being without a second vote in the United States Senate. There are 99 senators. Every other state has two votes. We only have one because of the extended situation, which Senator Rest has suggested some ways to reduce. If votes cast for Dean Barkley, however, in Election Day and other less popular candidates would have been redistributed based on the voters' choice of their second most popular candidate, we'd probably have either Al Franken or Norm Coleman with a majority of votes and sitting in the United States Senate now, casting votes for Minnesota so that we're heard on the incredibly important issues being faced by the congressional, by Congress this year. In summary, because of the added expense, the reduced voter participation and therefore disenfranchisement, an additional campaign we think that Senate File 791 would trigger, we believe it's not the right approach to enhance our democracy.
Are there any questions for the witness? Senator Gerlach?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rest, I'm supportive of your bill, but I'm wondering if did you want, to, based on the testimony, did you want to spend the afternoon debating instant runoff voting today, or is that another day? Or
I was confused
by the testimony about what issue we were debating. Is it about the runoff or was it instant runoff voting?
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, Senator Gerlach, I didn't understand. I didn't hear the last part of what you were saying.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well,
I heard you're supportive of my bill.
Yes.
I heard that part.
I would say I'm supportive of your bill.
Yes.
And the runoff, but I was just saying I was confused by the testimony of Senator Hottinger on the or Mr. Hottinger on the issue of I wanted to know if you wanted to spend the afternoon debating instant runoff of voting.
Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, no, I don't obviously, but I certainly appreciate that instant runoff voting is an alternative to, for either a runoff election or a recount. I mean, theoretically, instant runoff voting could also result in a recount because the difference between the top two vote getters, even in instant runoff voting, could be, on the current law, less than 15,000. So for those that want to bring forward instant runoff voting, they also have to have a mechanism to not continue to have either, a recount. It'd have to go to also an election contest because otherwise it's a irrational result. I don't know if that answers your question. I appreciate my good friend's comments, but I'd rather have a concentration and discussion on whether this bill is an adequate way of addressing a very, very close statewide races. And it's not just U.S. Senator, but it's also the constitutional officers.
Senator Hottinger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Gerlach, we don't have a proposal in front of you for instant runoff voting. We're exercising something that is new now. It's called fiscal responsibility. We are trying to make sure that the state is ready for a use of instant write-off voter, and we don't put additional expense in counties and cities in the state for new machines more rapidly than they can accommodate them. In addition, instant write-off voting is going to be tried in Minneapolis, and we'll have an experience. But we are concerned that this proposal that in Senate File 791 be considered the appropriate response. And if you're supportive of the bill and support the extra money and support the disenfranchisement of voters and support the prolonged campaign, you know, we're, that's your decision.
Okay. All right. Thanks all.
And Madam Chair, I think the expense argument, that's certainly a consideration. And the length of the campaign, that's certainly a consideration. And we know right now, under the current system, that millions and millions of dollars are being spent under this system. We also know that, I don't know if we know this, but there's at least been some discussion that if the recount had been done in a central place, that it would cost about the same as a runoff election, and that there have been a lot of disputes that came up, not only in the recount, but also in the election contest, about whether or not a ballot was to be accepted. So I think that it's not that the current system costs nothing, including the cost of not having a member of the United States Senate, two of them, as opposed to this bill costs something and current law costs nothing, or this bill costs something and IRV costs nothing. That claim simply cannot be made. So I think it is an issue to be brought up at for any kind of proposal that comes forward. But to say that one proposal costs money and another one does not, I would argue against that.
And Senator Rest, just to add to that, if this bill would move forward and move through the full committee, I would anticipate it would need to go to the finance.
Oh, absolutely.
Division.
Yeah, and even though there's
finance
no
committee.
Fiscal note, that would go there for a fiscal note in my mind to give us the notion of what it costs to run an election, not because we're anticipating one coming. So I don't know how they do those kind of fiscal notes, but I would certainly want the members to be aware that if this bill passed, that and it ever came about, that there would be that would not be without cost.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize because I confused things here. I was confused myself. I wasn't paying close enough attention to where we were at with who was supporting what. So I'm very, very much in favor of this bill before us. And I misconstrued Mr. Hottinger's what he was getting at as the alternative. So I think definitely we need to go with Senator Rest's bill, and we'll take up the debate when Senator Marty gets his IRV bill up in front of the committee. So thank you.
Madam Chair, I would also indicate that there is a growing support in other areas of the country for IRV. I actually lived in a community in Cambridge, Massachusetts on more than one occasion, which elected their city council members that way. And they are indeed one of the communities that's quite comfortable with it. However, after you voted on election day, back in the 70s when I was doing that, it was a couple of months before we found out who won because they did not have the technical sophistication to determine that preference voting. And that may well be an issue for the city of Minneapolis. I think it's going to be a very good laboratory to determine whether or not that is a viable system either for a city or for a state for us even to consider, aside from whether you believe that that's a good policy moving forward.
Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on Senate File 791? All those in favor of
move the bill then.
Senator Rest would move that. Excuse me. Senator Rest moves that Senate File 791 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rest.
Stephen, the first bill you want to take up is of your four is
Senate File 801, please, Madam Chair.
We have Senate File 801 before the subcommittee. Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there should be an amendment. Is there an amendment, Mr. Bonin? Then we do have a couple of small oral amendments that we'd like to move to get the bill in the shape.
Do we have a written amendment, first of all, Senator Sieben, or are they all oral amendments?
It's all oral amendments.
Except Mr. Bodern, direct us.
Madam Chair, and I think Ms. Fraser may have some to add to this, but my understanding there was one amendment on page 5, line 27. Need to delete, comma, including auto collisions.
So delete the comma, and including auto collisions?
Correct.
Senator Sieben moves to, on page 5, line 27, to delete the comma and the words including auto collisions. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Oppose? Well, let's do that again. In favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
And
Senator Sieben?
Ms. Fraser does have a couple of other amendments that I'd like to offer.
Ms. Fraser, would you direct us to where we should take those up?
Yes, Madam Chair, Beth Fraser from the Office of the Secretary of State. On that same page, on 5.25, remove the words to the counting location, which refers to more of a central count. System.
Again, these are author's amendments. Senator Sieben moves on page 5, line 25, to strike to the counting location. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, two more changes, which I think can be done in one amendment. They're both on page 7, on line 7.28, remove metal strap with a. So it would read a numbered self-locking device.
Senator Sieben moves to strike
metal
on page 7, line 28, metal strap with a.
And then, Madam Chair, also on line 7.29, delete the word metal. Or I'm sorry, on the line after it, on line 7.29, delete the word metal.
Senator Sieben moves to delete on page 7, line 28, metal strap with A, and on line 7.29, metal. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Sieben, anything else?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. This is largely a technical bill that makes some conforming changes, but I would like Ms. Fraser from the Secretary of State's office to run through a description of the bill.
Ms. Fraser?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill, as Senator Sieben said, is primarily a housekeeping bill. The statute still reflects the way that things used to be done in Minnesota when different races were on different colored ballots. We had a white ballot for state races, a canary ballot, a blue ballot, a pink ballot, sometimes a gray ballot. There were lots of different colored ballots, and ballots, for the most part, were hand counted. Chapter 206 was added, which has to do with electronic voting equipment, but for the most part, that language refers to central counting locations and punch card voting, which isn't the system that we use here anymore. So this bill gets rid of language related to colored ballots and to multiple ballot boxes because you had to put the yellow ballot in the yellow ballot box. It consolidates language. So right now we're trying to consolidate all of the language related to formatting ballots into Chapter 204D, all of the language regarding election preparation into 204B as in boy, and all of the language related to election judge duties into 204C. The only real substantive changes in this bill have to do with ballot design, and they're fairly minor as well. One is that right now the statute requires that ballots be in all caps, which studies have shown time and again is harder to read than upper and lower case letters. So this makes the change from words in all caps to using upper and lower case letters. It also modifies some of the ballot instructions slightly to make them easier to understand, and it changes the description of a vacancy. Right now, language on a ballot when you're filling a vacancy may say something like special election for a school board member to fill a vacancy in a term expiring. So we're shortening that to vacancy in term expiring consistently. So I'd be happy to run through the bill section by section, but generally that's what we're doing.
Senator Sieben and Ms. Fraser and members, I find it interesting that we still had in the statutes on their Section 8 a direction to voters to mark an X in the ballot when we haven't been doing that for some time. And I see that you are indicating that the voter is filling in an oval or connecting an arrow opposite the president printed name of each candidate. I'm assuming that all of these ballots initially are all ballots now, and are they all machine counted?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, no. There are some precincts, even in state general elections, that do hand count ballots.
And are there any ballots anywhere that are printed which do not have the opportunity to either fill in an oval or connect a name with the ballot? And would this make a change? Are there any ballots that go out now anywhere where the proper thing to do is to mark an X? Or we saw in an advertisement for a sample ballot in a newspaper where they indicated the proper thing to do was to put a check mark next to someone's name. Are there any ballots that are actually printed that way?
Madam Chair, all ballots for all elections in Minnesota have to be machine readable and use the ovals and arrows, with the exception of standalone township elections in small townships and standalone hospital district elections. In those two elections, they are allowed to use ballots that are not readable by a machine, and this would require them to change how they design the ballots from putting a box and instructing voters to mark an X to instead drawing an oval and telling voters to fill in the oval.
And so all ballots would then be consistent across races with this change, even if the ballots were
going to be paper ballots and only counted by hand, such as in the township elections or the hospital district elections.
Madam Chair,
correct?
Yes.
So all ballots will be the same. There'll be no ballots that have a box with an X.
Madam Chair, check. Yes.
Okay, just wanted to clarify that. Are there questions for Senator Seidman or Ms. Fraser, Senator Gerlach?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a co-author on the bill here, so I've got to kind of take a look closely here. I remember Senator Seidman asked me to sign on, in which I didn't. We talked about different ballot things and the obsolete things. But I want to ask you about this Section 2, which is the capital to lowercase. And what Ms. Fraser said about the lowercase being easier to read than uppercase, I believe is true if you're reading a paragraph. If I was reading an entire page of text or a book, sometimes we get emails, sometimes from our constituents, which are in all caps, and difficult to read. So I agree with that. However, in the case of a ballot, I'm thinking, you know, I think there's a reason that particular segments are in uppercase. And in this case, it's only one sentence. And the intent, I believe, is to draw a voter's attention to it to make clear with to make it clear that they see that what they are doing is, in this case, for a tax referendum. So I'm uncomfortable going to the lowercase on that. I think there's an intent of why it's an uppercase, why we bold things or italicize things. It's to draw attention to it, and it's one sentence. It's not a whole paragraph. So my question is, Senator Seidman, how wedded are you to Section 2 in this bill? How important it is to you? If you thought, you know, if we could maybe leave it as is with the uppercase, if it's something you really want to keep in there, I'll vote for the bill here to get, you know, the subcommittee, but then if you want to keep it in here, I would like to discuss this further and explore the rationale more on this with you. So it's your choice at this stage, but I'll tell you, I like the idea of leaving it in the all caps because I think there was an intent there to draw attention to it.
Senator Seidman and Senator Gerlach, there would also be that issue unless if you would look at Section 8. That's simply the yes-no issue where they go from caps to uppercase, lowercase. I don't believe it's in, I mean, if we're going to have a discussion, it should be of all those sections. I did not see it anywhere else, but Ms. Fraser, do you know, or Senator Seidman, do you know where it may have come up again?
It's also on page 31.
Section just so we can have full discussion on that.
I don't know if it's anywhere else. But Senator
Section 31?
Section 60. Page 31.
Page
31.
Right. To your point, Senator Gerlach, I understand the distinction.
Which is Section 60. So it's Section 2, Section 8, and Section 60.
Okay. And there could be other sections. I'm not sure. But to your point, Senator Gerlach, I do understand your rationale here and how we do want this language to be differentiated from the rest of the text. So, you know, I'd be happy to keep it the way it is and agree to work with you to come up with some sort of solution. You know, we could potentially bold the text where this is referenced or underline it to distinguish it from the other text. If we do believe that it's easier to read upper and lower case, but we still want to distinguish the text from the rest of the ballot, I'd sort of leave that up to you, I guess.
Senator Gerlach?
Madam Chair and Senator Seidman, like I said, I'm not going to hold up the bill today on that, but I think that these are such short sentences that maybe we should just leave it as is. I mean, I think the gain from making it, you know, easier to read in a sentence, and then, of course, putting in these changes of making whether it's bold or italics, do we need to do that? I don't know. My inclination is that we should just, you know, the uppercase, it's there for, I think, you know, a reason. I think it serves a good purpose. It's only one sentence. I don't know that it really makes it hard to read, being such a short sentence. I'd like to leave it, but I won't hold up the bill. If you want to leave it as is right now, I don't think we want to discuss then today about bolding it or whatnot. So, I mean, I'd prefer we just take them out. But, again, I just noticed that now. I'm a co-author on the bill. I'm not going to hold it up. But if you want to leave the, you know, leave it in as it is, we can leave it there today. But then I definitely would like to talk to you more about that and try to persuade you.
Senator Sieben?
Senator Gerlach, I understand your point. And if the rest of the committee feels like we should take it out, then I'm happy to do that today. Otherwise, we can leave it in and then continue to work on it. I don't feel real strongly.
I don't, Senator Ross, maybe you have some thoughts
Senator
on
Gerlach,
it.
Senator Gerlach, would you like to make a motion?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't want to make a motion, again, against the author of the bill unless there's a consensus, unless it makes sense.
You'll
so, I mean, if you have, if you, you would, okay, well, then, that, you know, and I, then, well, there's, I mean, maybe Senator Olsen has some comment on it before we make any kind
Senator
of motion.
Senator Olsen?
Madam Chair, having been a school board member for 10 years, you know, these were always questions for us, you know, that the language on a referendum question, you know, we didn't like that was in there in the first place, but this is kind of this language that just says that a referendum is scheduled to expire. I mean, that's very different than, you know, the ones that used to say this will cause an increase to your property taxes. So I really don't have concern either way. I think the bold printing, that's okay with me.
Or the all cap printing is
yes.
Okay.
Senator Rest and the rest of the committee, I'd just like to point out that if Senator Gerlach, if you do want to delete it, perhaps we'd only delete sections 2 and 60 because section 8 does not refer to a tax issue.
That, and it, yes, I see the yes, Madam Chair, I see the difference between that, and that's fine.
Senator Gerlach, then, do we have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll move then that sections 2 and it was 16?
6D.
Oh, I'm sorry, 60. Oh. Sections 2 and section 60 be deleted from the bill then.
Heard Senator Gerlach's motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there any discussion on any other section of the bill? Is there anyone else who would like to testify either in favor or in opposition to any provision in the bill? None. Senator Sieben moves that Senate file 801 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the full committee. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Sieben now has you have three other bills. Do you want to just take them in order?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Yes, please.
Okay. Then Senator Sieben brings us Senate File 970, Early Voting.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, this early voting bill attempts to get at what I think the last election pointed out, that we had the highest turnout in the nation in terms of voters who turned out to vote, 77.8% of all Minnesotans voted, which resulted in 2.93 million ballots being cast. And yet over 12,000 absentee ballots were rejected, which, as we all know in this room, was much larger than the difference between the two candidates in the U.S. Senate race. So of those 12,000 ballots that were rejected, approximately 10,800 were properly rejected. So we had over 10,000, nearly 11,000 Minnesotans who intended to vote in the U.S. Senate contest, but their ballots were rejected and they were effectively disenfranchised. And I think that the although the absentee ballot system certainly has its benefits and merits, it is safe to say that there are also challenges with voting absentee. And as more and more Minnesotans now vote by absentee ballot for a variety of reasons, I think it's something that we as legislators should be concerned about why so many of these absentee ballots are being rejected. And I think that speaks well for why Minnesota should join the 31 other states that allow for early voting. It certainly is a matter of convenience for voters, but another policy issue here, I think, is that it would effectively reduce, by instituting early voting, it would reduce the number of voters who need to vote or who choose to vote by absentee ballot, because if we institute this early voting system, voters would be able to go to the polls and cast a regular ballot, not an absentee ballot, and then, you know, feed their ballot directly into the voting machine, and then if there were any problems with the way they filled out their ballot or other reasons that ballots can later be rejected, oftentimes the machine would be able to catch some of those discrepancies. I don't have any data specific to Minnesota, but the 2004 Census Bureau data show that 15.4% of Americans did not vote because of illness or disability. 9% were out of town, and almost 20%, 19.9%, did not vote because they were too busy or their schedule did not allow them to. So I think that instituting a system of early voting in Minnesota is certainly a matter of convenience. And I would argue that, you know, as we are in the 21st century now, it makes sense to try to move away from a system of allowing for voting only on Tuesdays, but instead make it more convenient so that voters have more opportunities to vote and cast a regular ballot on days preceding the traditional election day. Paul Gronke is an expert on voting matters, and he's at Reed College. His research shows that early voting would not necessarily increase turnout in high turnout elections, such as the most previous general election. But his research also shows that early voting would increase turnout in traditionally low turnout elections. So again, I think that speaks to the convenience point here, that early voting may not necessarily increase our turnout in elections such as the one we had in November, but in lower turnout elections, early voting has been shown to increase turnout. So,
Senator Sieben, I noticed that Oregon, as well as others, have all mail-in votes. What is the voter turnout, do you know, of those states that do all of their elections by mail?
Madam Chair, I don't know the exact number for Oregon, but I believe that if I recall,
I can't tell from the gradations
the
on the chart which other states have that.
No, you're correct that that Oregon is the only state that has all mail voting. I think that they did have, Oregon did see a dramatic increase in the Oregon did see a dramatic increase in the amount of people who voted when it was first instituted in the general elections, and now those numbers have gone back to the way it used to be. But Oregon does see a much higher percentage of people voting in lower turnout, non-presidential elections than other
states. We did get evidence on the mail-in voting, and I know that's not what this is, that for those townships under 400, is it, that were allowed to do that, that they have a very, very high voter turnout. And we had that one bill. Senator Olsen, was that your bill?
I don't think so.
To increase it to 1,000?
It was Senator Lori's, I believe.
Senator,
wasn't it?
Senator
it was your Senator
Olsen. Olsen, it was your bill. To allow
For the townships?
Yeah, for the townships that are in entities that had, moving that threshold up to 1,000 votes, that based on the experiences of the townships of fewer than 400.
Madam
Sieben.
Madam Chair, I do have the A1 amendment that I'd like to offer to get the bill in the shape that I would like, and then Mr. Bodern will help me make an amendment to the amendment.
Senator Sieben moves the A1 amendment, and now you want to incorporate another amendment within the A1?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Mr. Bodern?
Madam Chair, on the A1 amendment, on page 2, delete lines 16 to 19. And then this would also involve changes to the bill as well, orally. On the bill, on page 3, line 19, delete third and insert fourth.
Sorry, say that last one again.
On page 3, line 19 of the bill, delete third and insert fourth. And then on page 3, line 24, delete 4 o'clock and insert 12 o'clock. And delete the
12 p.m.?
Yes.
Okay.
You can delete 4 p.m. and insert 12 o'clock. Let me change that. Why don't we make that noon to be absolutely clear?
Okay.
And on also on page 3, line 24, delete the and insert at least one. And I will point out that on the A1 amendment changes the length of time that the early voting must be available to 30 days before the election. The oral amendment here extended it through the fourth day before the election, which would be the Friday. And the effect of the oral amendment to Section 7 would be to require early voting on at least one Saturday before the election from the hours of 8 a.m. to noon.
Madam Chair, after speaking with the townships and the cities who had some concerns about when early voting would occur, this amendment essentially would say, like Mr. Bodern described, that at least one Saturday in the early voting period, which would run for 30 days before the election, at least one Saturday, except for the Saturday immediately before the Tuesday regular election day, that the polling place must be open from 8 to noon on at least one Saturday.
But not the Saturday before the Tuesday of the election.
Correct. And that is so that local election officials would have time to prepare the everything they need to before the election.
Okay, this is
move that amendment.
An author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Now, Senator Sieben, to the bill, including the effect of the amendment.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to add before I ask my testifiers to add their testimony that I did go back and forth about how long the early voting period should be, but essentially concluded that keeping the early voting period consistent with when people are allowed to vote in person absentee was perhaps the easiest way to administer this. I believe that, you know, essentially it is up to the voter to decide if they would want to vote 30 days before an election. They're taking that chance or risk that something could change, but yet they're making that informed decision to vote that early. But if people are voting absentee and are voting in person early right now, or are voting in person by absentee currently, like we heard in the full committee, Roseville had 17.3% of all votes cast were cast by absentee ballot, and many of those were cast in person by absentee. People are already voting early right now, and it just seems that it would make the most sense to keep the days consistent so that when in-person absentee voting is available, then early voting should also be made available, because one effect that we want this to see happen is that we reduce the number of people who vote in person absentee and instead cast a regular ballot, so that it decreases the likelihood that more of those ballots will not be rejected. So with that, first I'd like to ask Ms. Fraser to provide testimony.
Ms. Fraser, if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. And I want to thank Senator Sieben for bringing forward this bill and for working with us on changes to it. We are very supportive of going to a system of early voting in Minnesota. In some ways, it's a significant change. In other ways, it's not, in that lots of Minnesotans are currently voting early. It's just they have to go and make up an excuse and put their ballot in an envelope and then in another envelope and then sign it and hope that it's accepted and sent to the polling place to be counted. And right now, that is a cumbersome situation. Occasionally, there are problems with it, as we've seen, and it's also expensive. It's more expensive to pay for all of those applications, all of those envelopes, all of the election judges that then have to go through them and accept and reject. And so we believe that this would, for in-person voting, streamline the process, reduce costs at the local level, and be much more convenient for voters. With all of the national attention this year on early voting and announcements about when it was available, I think there was lots of confusion about Minnesota and whether we had it or not. Many, many in-person absentee voters showed up and said, I'm here to vote early. And, you know, election officials here had to say, we don't have early voting. You have to vote absentee. Do you have an excuse? And so I think many voters were surprised by the hurdles that were in place for casting a ballot prior to Election Day. As Senator Sieben explained, voters choose when to cast a ballot. And if a voter decides that they're sure enough about their choices 30 days ahead and casts their ballot, then that's the choice they've made and the risk they've taken that something could come out or change about, you know, in the race. Now, the same thing could happen at noon on Election Day. If I cast my ballot at 7 a.m., the scandal could break at noon, and my ballot's in the box, it's too late, I've made my choices and can't vote again. So voters will need to make an educated choice about when they cast their ballot and when they're sure about their choices. I think that, you know, in terms of changing in-person absentee to early voting, That does change election procedures, and we have been in conversation with local election officials and Senator Sieben, and will continue to be in conversation with them about the tweaks that need to be made to this language and how to make sure that we're putting in place a system that will work for everybody. So I'd be happy to answer any questions or to go to the next testifier.
Are there questions for Ms. Fraser before we go on to the other testifier? Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Ms. Fraser, I'm more interested in the logistics of this because I support it too, but somebody was telling me that the electronic machines can be programmed up to 34 precincts or something like that. So if you go to a fairly medium-sized county, you'd probably be voting at the courthouse, and the ballot would be assigned to each precinct, but would they physically go to the precinct, or how would that all play out?
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Senator Rolstein, different voting machines can handle different numbers of precincts, and the voting machines, I believe, in four of the metro counties can handle up to 34 or 35 precincts, whereas the voting machines used in most of the rest of the state can only handle up to 10, which is a challenge. The vision is that there would be an optical scanner in the county office or the city office where early voting is being administered, and that as soon as it's programmed and ready, voters that came in would be able to put their ballot right into the machine. Part of the amendment that Senator Sieben put forward would delay implementation until voting machines could handle at least 30 precincts. Only being able to handle 10 is problematic. In Hennepin County, for example, there are 500 precincts. So they would need to have 50 machines in their office, which would be crowded in addition to somewhat potentially confusing and potentially expensive because the counties need to be able to have enough machines. There are in kind of the pipeline for certification, our understanding is that there are machines that or cards to be put into machines that we currently have that could handle hundreds of precincts. So we believe that the technology is in the pipeline, will be available soon, and that this could be implemented. But we are aware that with the current technology, if nothing else is certified, that there are challenges, and the amendment kind of addresses those.
And just to be clear, Senator Olstein, as Ms. Fraser said, that it wouldn't, the system would not be implemented until the technology was available, until we had the technology so we could indeed accept ballots into from a variety of different precincts.
Thank you. The next person on the list is Bill Haney. Welcome to the committee, subcommittee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Haney. I'm legislative and political director for the IBEW Minnesota State Council, representing 13 local unions throughout the state of Minnesota, having over 16,000 members also throughout the state. We are here in support of Senate File 970 because it fixes a problem faced by many of our members, a problem which could compromise their right, their ability to vote. Around 6,000 of our members work for utilities, and many of those workers are subject to emergency call-out because of storm damage, floods, ice storms, tornadoes, and other customer service outages. And in most of those situations, the workers work often very long hours, and frequently they're out of town for an undetermined period of time. Could be a day, could be a week or two or longer, depending on the severity of the damage that they have to repair. And they really don't know in advance if they're going to be called out on an emergency because it hasn't happened yet. So this bill would provide a very good fix to that dilemma that those workers face. Utilities also have cooperative agreements with utilities not only contiguous to their service territory but throughout the state and the region and in some cases even nation to provide workers and equipment to help the utility that's been knocked out by some natural disaster get its customers back online. There were members from Minnesota that were down in New Orleans after Katrina. The additional reason for supporting this bill is we feel it will take a lot of the heat off of concerns and issues surrounding absentee ballots that may be, you know, another option for people. But it takes a lot of the heat off of that process because people could actually go down to their city hall or wherever and vote early, and that would take care of that. So we urge you to support this bill, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Haney. Are there any questions or comments for Mr. Haney? Seeing none, thank you very much. Gwen Myers, League of Women Voters, Minnesota. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gwen Myers. I am a volunteer lobbyist with the League of Women Voters of Minnesota. The League believes that voting is a fundamental right, and it must be both guaranteed and promoted in our democracy. Our 89-year-old organization was created by people, women, who organized around the right to vote, so we have a very special affection for suffrage. LWVMN supports Senate File 970 for a very simple reason. It makes it easier for Minnesotans to vote. There are many reasons why people may take this opportunity. People have jobs that are somewhat unpredictable, as was just testified. as to hours or days when they will be in town. Excuse me. The flexibility of being able to cast a ballot any time in the month preceding the election will be welcome. Sorry. People who know they will not be in their precinct on election day may wish to take advantage of the simpler early voting opportunity rather than the more complicated absentee ballot process. Students have classes on the first Tuesday in November. They will appreciate the flexibility of being able to vote early. People who are frail or disabled may wish to vote early, avoiding sometimes long lines at the polls. And people have unpredictable medical conditions, and here our hotline turned up a remarkable variety. We took a number of calls on election day from people whose health had taken an unexpected turn for the worse, and they were desperate to vote, and they were stuck at home. And we even had one from an obstetrician who had just performed an emergency, thank you very much, who just performed an emergency C-section for a woman who was desperate to vote. And I hope we got her name because we should send her a card to join the League of Women Voters. but these are situations which, if we had this month of flexibility, would not arise. While we understand that early voting may provide other advantages, not least reducing the number of absentee ballots, the League's primary reason for supporting Senate File 970 is that we'll make voting more convenient for our citizens who wish to take part in our democracy. We urge your support. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Myers. Are there questions or comments for Ms. Myers? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that would like to testify? Welcome to the committee, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. Let me first say that I don't have a problem with early voting. I always vote early. I vote absentee.
Early in the day
or absentee.
What is your excuse?
I'm not in the precinct because I'm working. But as this bill applies to school districts and their elections, we think that there's going to be some problems trying to get this system up and making sure that the system works correctly. What we think it should really only apply to the statewide elections. I mean, that's the ones where you have the huge turnouts and that, whether it's the year the governor's up or whether it's the year the president's up. Our first position would be not to apply it to school district elections or to township elections, as for that matter, because it doesn't work for them either.
And what do you mean by it doesn't work for you, Mr. Dean?
It's going to create some fairly large expenditures for us. We're going to have to rent those machines for a month. We're going to have them there. We're going to have people running those machines every day and then counting the things that night. There are some other provisions that we think you need to fix here, which we haven't had really much of an opportunity to talk to Senator Sieben about since the bill just got introduced yesterday afternoon. But we did meet earlier on some of the earlier voting things. But, for instance, we can't hold school events on the day that an election is held. I don't know whether this constitutes a day that an election is held or not. We would certainly want that to be clarified, because otherwise we'd be blocking out a month when you couldn't have games or you couldn't have any school events when that's happening. That's certainly not anybody's intention. We understand that. There's also provisions in here that relate to use of partisan election judges from each major party. School districts are generally exempt from those provisions, and we think that those need to be put in. But I think our major point is that we know that it's going to take a little bit to get this thing so that you have all the kinks ironed out of it. And what we would suggest is if you think that it should apply to local elections, that you not make it apply until elections that are held in 2014 and thereafter. So you'd have two cycles of statewide elections. Then it would kick in for elections that were held in 2014. Then you'd have that. You'd have the opportunity to come back here to the legislature for a number of years, fix the things that are found wrong, and then if the system works, we pick up additional expenditures. School district offices are not open on Saturdays. They're not open at night. You know, the people that work in those offices don't work at night. So that they're going to pick up that expenditure. I assume this isn't going to K-12 for a look at that issue. But what we would really ask for is that the provisions not apply to elections not held in conjunction with a statewide election until 2014 and thereafter.
Mr. Deans, election bills don't routinely go to K-12 committee no. simply because there are school elections involved in them. How many occasions now, other than for a bond referendum for a school building, are elections in school districts held on days other than the general election and the general and the primary election?
Madam Chair, we're going to actually reach this deal when we get to one of the later bills. In 1995, the legislature changed the law as it related to school district elections. School district elections used to be annual elections. You changed the law then that we would run every other year for four-year terms. The number keeps changing. There's a fairly substantial number of school districts that still have odd year elections.
I don't mean that. I mean on a general election day.
Their general elections are in the odd year. There are a number of school districts whose general elections are in the odd year.
I know, but they
run alone.
They don't have elections in May or June is what I'm saying. It is
That's
the
correct.
General election day, whether it is in an odd year or an even year, because
yes.
some municipal elections are held simultaneously with school board elections, not all the time, and sometimes only in part of a district.
That's right.
Also, you can
have,
in a primary day election, you can have an operating referendum if a district is in statutory operating debt. So they do make use of, whether it is in an odd number year or an even number year, unique day, just to clarify that.
Right.
Is that, and
but,
that's,
yes,
you can say that's correct.
In many school districts, let's just take that odd year general election. In many of those school districts, that is entirely a standalone election. We have, I believe, 70 cities have their election in the odd year as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those school districts will have an overlap in part with one of those cities. In that case, the city runs that part of the election for the school district, and then the school district runs the rest of it. It's kind of a complicated feature.
Well,
and
Mr.
Then,
Dean, if we exempted school districts and townships from the bill, that would mean that people could early vote for president or governor, but then they'd still have to go to a poll and vote in a school district election that was held in an even-numbered general election date.
Senator, you misunderstood what I said. I suggested that we delete them for elections not held in conjunction with a statewide election. If the election is being held in an even-numbered year, it doesn't matter to us because we don't run those elections. The cities and counties run those elections. And that, in that case, you would have the early voting. They would be able to go in. Yeah, whether you were running for the governor, you had the gubernatorial election,
okay.
You had the presidential election. People would the early voting procedures would apply there. We don't run those elections. The cities and townships and counties run those elections.
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, I think if the committee was going to consider a phase-in plan, as Mr. Dean suggests, I think it would be better to phase in by full counties, because I think it's going to be very confusing for the voter if in one election they get to vote early, but in the next election they don't get to vote early. So that's just, you know, my feeling. And I don't know if we're going to think that a phase-in plan is good or not. Then my other question is a different topic, and I apologize. I'm in another committee at the same time. And to Senator Sieben, why are we not allowing early voting on the Monday before the election?
Senator Pappas, that is because local election officials came to me and said that they were concerned that they would not have time to prepare all of the documents necessary to prepare for election day.
And Senator Pappas, by amendment, she also excluded the Saturday before the election.
Deleted
well.
The Saturday before?
Yes.
Correct.
That there had to be, the amendment provides that there has to be at least one Saturday during mm-hmm. that 30-day period where early voting would be permitted, but that it could not be the Saturday before the Tuesday election day.
And then, Madam Chair?
No.
Senator Pappas.
Senator Sieben is, I assume absentee voting, though, was still allowed in addition during this whole period.
That's correct, Senator Pappas.
So you could vote absentee on Monday.
That's correct. Although
I think
your
we have in-person absentee.
In-person absentee balloting needs to end 24 hours before the polls open, is it?
Madam Chair,
is in-person absentee, the question is in-person absentee balloting permitted on the Monday before election? Ms. Fraser or Mr. Bodern, someone?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, I haven't had a chance to study the author's amendment, so I'm not entirely sure exactly how this is set up right now. I think that election administrators would probably prefer that you couldn't do in-person absentee on the Monday before, that you could probably still get an absentee ballot, and I guess
talk about that, though.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Right now it ends at 5 p.m. on Monday.
Senator Rest, if Ms. Fraser could please respond to some of the School Board Association's
sure.
concerns.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one of the concerns that we have about exempting standalone school board and township elections is, as Senator Pappas was saying, confusion to the voters about, you know, that there are different rules in place for different elections, and I can go early for this one, but I show up and the door is closed for this one. And I'd be interested in speaking further with Mr. Deans about the increased costs, because my understanding is they do already have to administer in-person absentee voting. And to a large extent, administering the early voting will be very similar to and perhaps easier and less costly than administering the in-person absentee.
Ms. Fraser, maybe Mr. Deans later could respond to, I think, when they talk about no school activities on days of election, I know in voting absentee in person in my school district, that's not done at a school. It's done at the central office.
City Hall.
Ms. Fraser, go ahead.
Madam Chair, I don't think the intent is to stop all school activities for a month.
Right.
That election day is still election day. It's just that you can cast your ballot prior to election day. We do think that Mr. Deans' suggestion of a phased-in effective date probably does make sense. The author's amendment requires that we certify that everything's in place to do that. If we have certified, it may make sense to further amend the effective date so that if we've certified, cities that choose to do so could use it in 2009, and that after that it would be in effect for the 2010 primary and elections held thereafter. Mm-hmm. So most voters would encounter it in the 2010 primary, and it would be in place in all elections after that. But if cities wanted to try it out in 09 and we've certified, that they would be allowed to do so. That's one way of kind of approaching a more phased-in plan, not to the extent Mr. Dean suggested, but...
Mr. Dean, any response?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess any part of a loaf is better than no loaf. One of the problems is
you're
the way
such a practical person.
The way it's drafted right now, we don't know when the Secretary's office would certify that this stuff is available. So I think our people would have to plan for our November elections that are held this year that this would be in place.
Unless we exempt it.
Yeah, unless you exempt it. But, you know, we certainly would like at least one statewide run on this thing to get the kinks out and have them have the ability to bring it back to here, straighten that stuff out. Because the worst thing that can happen is that we do this and it gets out and the school districts and the townships totally screw it up. And that looks bad, and we don't want to be part of...
Sure.
Of hurting this system.
Right. Ms. Fraser, you didn't answer the question about, or maybe you don't know, is in-person absentee balloting today under current law allowed on the Monday before the general election day or primary election day on Tuesday?
Madam Chair, yes. It's allowed up until 5 p.m. on Monday.
So what's the difference between allowing early voting? And what is the difference anyway?
Madam Chair,
between
the large
early voting and in-person absentee voting?
Madam Chair, the large difference and the reason that local election administrators have convinced us that it should end earlier than Monday, because at first we really thought it should be available to voters on Monday, is that once you voted early, you're done voting. And the rosters will need to be marked, or information will be need to be sent to the precincts to ensure mm-hmm. that somebody cannot show up at their precinct on election day.
But if you do in-person absentee balloting, your ballot's not going to be counted until Tuesday.
But, Madam Chair, right now they have to send those ballots to the precincts, and when they...
But so it's not they're not counting it at that point. So they don't have to do anything for an in-person absentee voter on the Monday before election day other than to receive the ballot.
Correct, Madam Chair.
They don't have to mark any roster at that point.
That's right, Madam Chair.
Senator Stephen, under your bill, would you still be able, absentee voters would still be able to go to the polls on Tuesday and nullify their absentee ballot and be able to vote in person? Is that correct?
Chair, that's correct. But just to clarify, if you vote early, you would not be able to show up at the polls on Tuesday and vote again. And again, that's, to be real clear, that's why we'd want the early voting period to end on the Friday before the election, so that election administration officials would have time to prepare the roster to clarify who had voted early and who had not.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Dean's concern about school activities, I think that when you look at page 2 of the bill, the election law applicability, but when we're adding early voting on how they apply, we're adding it where absentee ballots are. So it would seem to me that I think I understand your concern, but I don't think it'd be a problem because you're allowed to have activities while absentee voting is. So I think that concern is addressed. But one other question maybe for the author. I think of one of the school districts that I have in my district. Moundsview has, I think, 6 or 7 cities in it. They would be required to have only one polling place at the county. What about if it's multiple counties? In other words, if they are having one and there are 3 counties, maybe it's only 2 counties in the district, how many polling places would they be required to have as a minimum? Because I'm just wondering about the expense if you have this for 30 days. But.
Senator Marty, I believe, well, I'll just ask Ms. Fraser to answer that just to make sure I don't screw it up.
Madam Chair, Senator Ms. Marty, I actually don't know the answer to that question, but they currently have to administer absentee voting, in-person absentee. So it would be the same as whether, for early voting. So if they only have to do it in one county for absentee voting currently, they would only have to do it in one county for early voting.
So, but maybe, Madam Chair, Mr. Dean,
Senator Morty,
for a school referendum or school board election when it's not on the same day as in November, the broader election, there is absentee balloting is taking place still at the same place. It'd be taking place at the county auditor.
It takes place if, Madam Chair, if we're in the odd year, if we're in the odd year, they would go to the school district office. They don't go to the county auditor. If it's in the even year, it would go through the county auditor or through the city or township.
And you wouldn't have anything to do with it anyway.
Yeah, we don't run those in an even
election.
Year. In the odd year, we run them, and they would come to the school district office to vote.
And, Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
With that, you know, I'm not sure who I'm asking, Mr. Deans or Ms. Fraser or the author, but is there going to be a big hassle then if they have a standalone school district election? Absentee voting right now would be in their district office. The polling place for early voting would be in the same place as well. Is there more, you have to have a machine there, obviously, but would there be more training required for the person who's the election judge who's there as opposed to absentee balloting? Is there any difference between the two, between absentee voting and that in terms of training and equipment?
Senator Marty, I think you got at the heart of the question, where the real difference would be that the new, if we had an early voting system, you'd have to have a vote tabulator, vote counter at the location. But and as Ms. Fraser has said, the bill requires that the ballot counters need to be. We need that technology so they're able to accept the multitude of different ballots that would be available. So I don't anticipate there would necessarily be any further training, but maybe Ms. Fraser has additional comments.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I think there would be somewhat different training. I don't think that there would necessarily be additional training required. Whenever we change something, we need to emphasize new things, but I don't think there would need to be additional training.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Ms. Fraser, I can believe you're right, but I just wanted to press it for a second, and that is that, so this has happened, let's say, in the school board case or township case or something where people aren't generally accustomed to running elections and so on. You would have to train that school district, whoever the election judge is, you'd have to make sure they understand both how to deal with ballots, applications and voting, and early voting and running it through the machine. You would have to do that. Is there a need for more people, though? Do you need to have, because of election judges, you have to have, do you want to have more than one person who wants
another committee?
Is there a concern about that? I'm just worried about the small elections, whether it's the township or the school board. Do you need to have two election judges there when somebody's putting in a thing in a machine to make sure that somebody's not slipping in something extra or?
We have no objection for us.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, there does have to be, under the bill, there do have to be two election judges there. I think that some of the language would allow staff to serve that role if there were two staff. I'm not sure I remember the whole question. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, I'm just trying to get at what the difficulties and expense would be, because 30 days or a few less than that, because you're not counting most of the weekend days, you're going to have people who are, if a school district or somebody's not running it. I assume they can rent the machines cheaply because nobody else is using the machines that week, that month. But in terms of the training and having people, two people there and so on, I'm just wondering, I understand your concern, and Senator Pappas, is that you don't want to have people, well, in this election we can vote early, that election we can't. But I also want to make sure we're not doing something that to a township or to a school district is really intrusive for that long of a period of time.
Madam, Madam Chair. The one thing is, I think that they, if they can, and I don't know whether I got this amendment written down right, but if they can vote every day between 8 and 4:30, and there's one day that was longer, I thought, but maybe that changed, and then you've got one Saturday that's in there. If the school district is normally closes at 4:30, and now after 4:30, if you look over here, that's when somebody has to be there to count these ballots every day, and assuming somebody's done this, and do it, somebody's going to be there after normal business hours, and somebody's going to be working on Saturday that wouldn't normally work on Saturday and wouldn't normally work after business hours. Now, I mean, that's, you know, I guess that's neither here nor there, but somebody's going to have to do it. When they come in and do the absentee, you know, you vote absentee if you vote in person or whatever. You do it during the day, and then they just, you know, put them in order, at the order that they receive. But here they actually have to do something more, and they have to do it after normal business hours, if you assume that ends at 4:30.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sieben.
I certainly understand the concerns that Mr. Deans has about this, and I'm sure the townships will have similar concerns. I think it's a question of policy as to whether it's more important for the committee to have consistency across the administration of all elections if we move this early voting proposal forward, or, and I can understand the concerns, you know, I'm willing, if the committee wants to do this, to say that standalone school board elections and standalone township elections can be exempt from these provisions because of the additional costs that would be required to administer it and some of the other concerns that were raised.
Mr. Bodern, can you do an amendment for that? Or Senator Sieben, how would you like to proceed on the bill if you're willing to have that happen?
Madam Chair?
Well, I guess I'd ask Mr. Bodern for guidance on whether it would be if it's a pretty simple amendment, then we could make the change now. Otherwise, I'd make the commitment that we could do it when it comes before the full committee if this subcommittee passes it along.
Okay. Mr. Bodern, is it an easy amendment or not so?
Madam Chair, might require a little bit of thought. It's possible that we could put language together that would clearly identify the intent and might be able to add more detail to it if necessary. I think at a minimum you'd want to, I'm thinking about the school district elections, if you had language in the bill that said it does not apply to an election held under, I think it's, is it Chapter 206, or excuse me, 205A, held in an odd-numbered year, that might suffice for now.
Okay. Senator Sieben, do you want to move that, and then you can work on that, because that would show your intent with regard to the full committee?
Sure. How do I do that?
Yeah, well, just move the language he just suggested.
Okay.
Senator Sieben moves the an oral amendment to the bill to indicate that the provisions of the bill do not apply to
school board elections that are not held in conjunction with
and
statewide.
Township elections?
Correct.
Are any of those held in? Okay. That, or how about to any elections that are held in exclude municipal elections, city elections. So to elections that are under the jurisdiction of townships or school boards. Is that your amendment?
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
I would like to add a sunset to that amendment of, you know, I think Mr. Dean had suggested 4 or 5 years or something, so that the bugs get worked out in the major elections by the, you know, the regular election officials. But I do think eventually the townships and the school board should also be allowing early voting. I think especially with, we don't often have enough people voting on school issues as it is now compared to some of the other elections. And I think it would be a good way to encourage more people to actually weigh in on school board elections.
So, Senator Sieben, would you like to include a clause that says this provision expires
for elections held in 2014?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, that is Senator Sieben's motion to amend the bill, 970. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak to Senate File 970? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, just on that past issue, because I think it is important that we postpone it, and I think it is a good decision to do it with the sunset, but I also think, Senator Pappas, at a certain point we may have to figure out, and before 2014 we'd have certainly the option to do so. Again, I know some of, I mean, I don't want to minimize the importance of any one vote because everyone's important, but if you have a township with a couple hundred people, and if we're going to have somebody saying, well, it's not that big of a deal to require two people to staff this and be there this time of day, when I assume townships often don't have people, period, there during the day, for 30 days because three people might come in and vote during that time.
I thought it was only 8 days.
It's 30 now.
Senator Pappas, there was a
30.
So, Madam Chair, I just think that that we should think about it, whether this is appropriate. I agree. I very strongly like the early voting concept, and I think the 30 days is good, but I think we should figure again how it's going to apply to the smaller independent units when they're on their own. So,
But, Senator Marty, they still are required to allow in-person absentee voting.
For
so
30
days. So they've got to have some place for them to go.
Madam Chair, current law is 30 days, too?
Right. For in-person absentee, okay. But I think Senator Marty's point is there would be additional requirements and burdens on the township or a school board for holding those elections because the requirements are different for conducting absentee balloting versus early voting.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with Senator Marty that I think that this amendment helps the bill a lot, but we should continue to think about whether how that would apply to townships and school boards after 2014 if this is enacted.
Is there further discussion, Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to confirm again, because I do think sometimes people intend to vote on Election Day and they find out on Monday that they're going to be away from the precinct. So I just wanted to confirm that we're still reserving the opportunity to vote in-person absentee on the Monday before the election. I want to get that.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, that is correct. This does not change any of the absentee ballot requirements in this language.
Because it happened to me.
Is there anyone else who wishes to express an opinion on Senate File 970 as amended? Senator Sieben, as you know, I have reservations about this bill, but I will save them for the discussion in the full committee, and they have to deal with the simultaneity principle in a democracy when we're casting a vote. So Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 970, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the full committee. All those in favor of that bill, that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Senator Sieben, members are getting nervous about
the time.
I do see that you have a testifier on your two other bills, but I also just took a look at them, and I think they would engender a lot of discussion. So what is your pleasure?
Madam Chair, it's up to the other committee members. I'm happy to stay. But the second bill, Senate File 768, will take a little bit of time.
Madam Chair, I think I have people waiting in my office.
Yeah, I'd rather leave, too.
Senator Rest.
Let's see. Schaefer Pellinen, is this subcommittee due to meet again?
We're not scheduled to meet again.
We're not scheduled to meet again. Senator Sieben, why don't we hear your other two bills in the full committee?
It's fine with me.
Okay. So Senate File 991 and 768 will not be heard today. When they are next scheduled, they will bypass the subcommittee and be held in the full committee. Stand adjourned.